The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And is it the volume okay, everyone? Great. So, in considering what to talk about this evening, what was a little bit of my mind was the topics of two sets of conversations that I've had this afternoon. And they make an interesting juxtaposition. The first one was a discussion about... I was asked to go to a local college, talk to the person who's in charge of the religious life for the students, to see what I or IMC could do about supporting the contemplative life of the students there. And I didn't know what to expect, and showed up to the person in charge of religious life, and on her desk where there's piles of books, kind of like on mindfulness and Buddhism, and seemingly, and it became clear very quickly that she was interested in having more mindfulness. She talked about an epidemic of stress, depression, suicide happening in universities around the country. And many universities are setting up wellness programs. And part of these wellness programs is to teach mindfulness and meditation. And her college was a little bit behind the curve with doing this, I think. And so she was looking for ways, especially since she's responsible for religious life for the community, is how to bring mindfulness in. And she said there's a lot of interest in the students. And I reflected that, I've noticed something has changed for us in the last few years, when I do, retreats regularly, standard length is 7-day silent retreats. And so people come, all kinds of ages come. And sometimes we have a lot of young people. In fact, last year we had a retreat that I helped teach for people in their 20s and 30s. And I was an honorary member. and a lot of I see a lot of people coming here and young who are coming and sitting a meditation retreat for the first time. And what stands out, compared to what I'm used to from many years ago, is how well they sit. That they sit very, very still, they're very disciplined, they're rather unruly, they're just like there to do the practice. Like they seem to know how to be on retreat. 20 years ago, someone who's never sat in retreat, who was in their 20s, would have had not a clue what to do, and they would have been stiff and not so easy to sit down, and they would have been restless and kind of questioning what was going on. And so I commented, I think that maybe that there's been a shift in our culture and that a lot more younger people are getting mindfulness growing up. And this person I was talking to said, yes, they're getting it in elementary school and high school and just kind of all over the country, she said. And that was kind of remarkable to hear. I mean, I kind of know there's this national kind of movement for mindfulness everywhere. But it was kind of interesting to see it, talked about that way. And what a change that's been in some 15, 16 years. About 16 years ago, maybe 17, we had meetings in a little room on the side here where we dreamt up and planned and organized and then put on the first conference, probably in the world, certainly the United States, on mindfulness and education. And some of us got the idea that this was a nice thing to promote. And so there were people here around the country who did a little bit of this, but not a lot. And there was one teacher in Salt Lake City who was kind of famous for teaching mindfulness in her classroom, like fifth grade classroom or something. And so there was a little bit happening, but it was very little. And so we were a little bit, in the forefront of kind of trying to support this whole mindfulness movement in education in schools. And we had rented a big auditorium in San Francisco, and Jon Kabat-Zinn came and gave the keynote speech, and people who were doing it from all over the country came because there had never been anything like this. And now it's everywhere. I don't know if it's everywhere, but it's a lot of different places. And so my son's home from college this evening, so I told him this, and he said, oh, yeah. Lots of kids know about it. And in fact, we have a meditation group in my fraternity. Now, when I was in college, those two didn't go together. Not in the universe I lived in. Unless there was lots of drugs involved or something. But, in my universe, when I went to college, I never would have dreamt my son would have been in fraternity. But anyway, that's besides the point. So that was one set of conversations. So that was nice. But I'm reflecting on this, and that what is IMC's role, what is my role as a Buddhist teacher in this shifting movement of mindfulness in our society. When I first started teaching Introduction to Mindfulness classes, mindfulness meditation, was probably in 1992, is my guess, first time I started to teach a class. I had no models for how to teach such a class. And so I made it up. And we're still kind of dealing with how I made it up. And it's kind of become a standard way here at IMC. But I didn't have any real models for how it's done. And I had never taken a Introduction to Mindfulness class. they hardly existed, right? And I learned mindfulness on retreat. And one of the concerns we had back then was to present the power of mindfulness, the benefits of mindfulness, without for people who had no interest in Buddhism. And so to offer it in somewhat secular fashion, and so I called it Buddhism Light, what we did, because the Buddhism part is not that important. It was mostly to teach this practice. But now that, as mindfulness is kind of swept over, secular mindfulness, and it's easy to get. You always do is get an app, and there's lots of, guided meditations, lots of teachings. I mean, there's an epidemic of this mindfulness. And secular mindfulness. So there's no need for IMC or for me as a Buddhist teacher to be a mindfulness teacher in that kind of secular way, because other people do it. Probably there's people who do it better than I do. And so that's not really... So what is it that we specialize in? What is it that that we have that as a Buddhist teacher, Buddhist center, that's maybe a little different? Is one of the questions. And should we now, since society has changed so much, should we really kind of now turn towards what we specialize in? It might not be as popular, but still is what we know and better. And the spread of mindfulness, other people are doing it now, and it's here established. So those are some of the thoughts in this first set of conversation. The second conversation, and also a little bit my reading and things I was doing, was a topic of nirvana. So, So it's kind of coincidence, right, that these two kind of concerns come together. So the word nirvana is a Sanskrit word. In our tradition, we call it nibbana instead of nirvana. The same word, just different, kind of slightly different language. And nirvana or nibbana is considered to be, you know, the highest goal, the ultimate goal of Buddhism. And the path of Buddhism, path of practice, goes toward to nibbana, to nirvana. And I remember probably 1994, 95, going to a sitting group in San Jose and said, I'm going to talk about nibbana. But before I do, do you have any questions? Well, we never got to nibbana. Because mostly what they wanted to talk about was how to deal with anger. It was a good conversation. It was great. But, you know, that was the interest. You know, nibbana is kind of abstract. It's kind of a distant goal. And, you know, it's, you know, maybe too ultimate. It's too kind of seems like more like a fairy tale or something. And so, you know, it's we want something that's relevant for our lives and what's here and here and now. So then I've been thinking about today about nirvana and nibbana. And so I wanted to share some thoughts about that. And as well, the Buddha has this quote where he says, "The holy life, the life of practice, Buddhist practice, is grounded upon nibbana, culminates in nibbana, ends in nibbana, and ends in nibbana. It is for the sake of nibbana that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One. Nibbana is the greatest happiness." Sometimes it's called the state of sublime peace. So this idea, so it's nibbana, what is it? And what is it that can be inspiring for us? What is it can make it a kind of a North Star or even a presence in our lives, so that it's something that actually feels relevant, feels important, something that's worthwhile to set, you know, set as a orientation for one's life. There are some people who make it the central purpose of their life, to really follow this path to its culmination and experience nibbana, have this experience of awakening, this transformation that this tradition talks about. And it's considered to be a very noble, dignified, worthwhile endeavor to go experience this this nibbana. Sometimes it's called the greatest form of health, the greatest bliss, the greatest happiness, the greatest peace. Sometimes it's understood to be the greatest insight. If you really want to understand what the essence is possible for a human being, or to have whole different eyes with which to see the world in a radically transformative way. So you're not seeing the world or seeing yourself or seeing others through the usual eyes that we just kind of grew up with, that nibbana is the means to have this radical change and transformation. In the tradition that I kind of grew up with in Buddhism, what nibbana is, what nirvana is actually less important than how it functions. And so the simile I like for this analogy is that if a person is thirsty, dying of thirst, learning what the molecular structure of water is before taking a drink of water is problematic. It's not interesting. What water is less interesting than drinking the water. So what nibbana is actually less important than how it functions as medicine, how it functions as a transformative experience that we can go through. And the transformation, the primary transformation that this nibbana is meant for, is to free a human being, you, if you're interested in this, from suffering. Really to kind of empty yourself of all this kind of mental, psychological stress, contraction, despair, fear, anger, that lives within human beings. It's a pretty radical promise that this can be done. Many people have no sense of how radical it is, really, until you go through it, until you go through that experience. I don't know what the good analogy would be, but it's maybe it's a kind of a, you know, pretty insignificant one comparison. But you know, I've been in my kitchen and didn't know how quiet the kitchen could be until the refrigerator stopped humming. So, wow, oh, that's nice. I didn't even know there was a stress of hearing that hum that goes on all the time. Or I've had shoes that I slowly over time didn't fit me anymore, were uncomfortable, but I just kind of went along with it and didn't think about it too much until I put new shoes on. It's like, oh, wow, what was I doing all that time wearing those shoes that were so uncomfortable? Sometimes it's only when we go through the transformation of really this of this nibbana can we look back and see what we've been living with, the level of stress, the level of attachment that we've been living with. So the function of nibbana is to release us from all of the mind's attachments, its clingings. Some people will protest at this point, well, what's wrong with attachment? Well, you know, maybe in some fundamental, existential, metaphysical way, maybe nothing. It just means you'll suffer. And, you know, that's maybe, if that's your thing, you know, that's okay. But it's, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, it would be like having a thorn in your foot and just keep walking. You know, what's wrong with having a thorn in your foot? You know, that's what happens to human beings. If you go barefoot sooner or later, you have a thorn in your foot, and, you know, it's just part of life. And why should I be concerned about taking it out? It's just, you know, doesn't hurt that much. And, you know, and there's important places to walk, so why should I stop to take it out? Whatever, you know. Which is kind of silly, right? You pulled out the thorn. The Buddha talked about a thorn or a dart that are in people's hearts. And he claims that he recognized he had a dart or an arrow or whatever the word is, a thorn in his heart. And he was looking for a solution, looking how to pull it out. And the experience in Nibbana was pulling that thorn out. And then people who have the experience of this transformation, this freedom of suffering, then they know something about suffering and know something about alternative to suffering, which is unparalleled. Something which is a gift to the world. Because, you know, you can certainly get relief from suffering. And some people who are fortunate maybe live relatively comfortable lives and don't suffer that much. But you know, that maybe their refrigerator hasn't stopped yet. And so they don't really see what they're actually living with. Some people are distracted from their suffering by the pursuits of life. If there are, you know, there's so many things to gain and get and have, especially here in Silicon Valley area. You know, there's cars to get, there's jobs to get, there's pleasures to have, there's all kinds of things, you know, new devices to get. And I've known people who have lived a life of anticipation of the next thing they're going to do, the next job, vacation, device, remodel, something. People I'm thinking about are pretty privileged. And they just kind of went from one, and so they would talk about it and kind of, you know, think about getting it, and then they got it, and then, you know, then they're on to the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing, which maybe is okay, but it's a distraction from really turning in and looking deep inside. What is really going on here? What's really, really happening within? Some people are not interested in Nibbana, but they're very interested in really checking out what's really going on in here. What is this human being? What is it to be a human? What's going on in this heart and this mind? let's get to the bottom of what's happening here. And that's what puts them on the path, to have that knowledge. Some people are on the path because their suffering is intolerable. And there's no other alternative for them in their lives. There's nothing else that makes sense. There are a few people, every once in a while you meet someone, they have no choice, really, but to be on the path to freedom. Because anything else for them, the suffering they've inherited, the suffering they've been grew up with, the challenges, the inner conflicts that somehow their society, family, their life situation created for them, the trauma they've had or something was so great that they don't want to live with this. And so they really need to do some radical medicine. And so they take the path of liberation, that this is the way I'm going to do this. And so the path to Nibbana is a path to something pretty fantastic. And what is Nibbana? So I said that what it does is less important than what it is, but it's a little bit interesting to talk about what Nibbana is. And first thing is that it is not something that is. if the is word refers to a thing. So it's not understood, it's not really a state. It's not a ontological reality. It's not like a plane of existence, like some transcendent place. And in a certain kind of way, it's not an experience. There are people who are experience junkies who are involved in Buddhism. They're doing Buddhist practice just to get good experiences. And Nibbana would seem to be the best of them all, but that's not what it is. It is kind of the best of them all, but it's not really an experience. And this idea that Nirvana is some kind of transcendent place, in Buddhism sometimes it's called the unconditioned. The life we normally lived in is considered to be a conditioned life. Say it in plainer English. It's everything that we touch and see and think and feel has been somehow created. Causes and conditions come together to create, to manifest this, whatever it is. And so the language is it's conditioned. Nibbana is said to be unconditioned. However, sometimes they add the word the in front of it. Nibbana is the unconditioned. Now we're getting into a thing, the unconditioned. And so it's like, and so some people will have the belief that Nibbana is some kind of higher plane of reality that is uncreated, unconditioned, timeless, eternal, that somehow is experienced or seen in the moment of experiencing Nibbana, having Nibbana happen. What's interesting is that the word Nirvana, the word Nibbana, is a noun, but in the original language, it's a verbal noun. So, you know, we can talk about, you know, Gil's walking when he walked with those shoes that didn't fit. His walking wasn't very good. And so the walking is there being used as a noun, though normally it's a verb, right? So it's a verbal noun. So in the ancient language, Nibbana is a verbal noun referring to an action being treated as a noun. So what is that action? The word Nibbana, Nirvana, is actually a metaphor. So that's very interesting that it's originally a metaphor. What's a metaphor? Metaphor itself is not the thing itself. A metaphor is just something that kind of poetically maybe describes something or kind of speaks about it. And the Buddha taught a lot in metaphor. There's a very famous sutta, a discourse called the Fire Sutta, where the Buddha has very emphatically says, the world is on fire. The eyes are on fire, the ears are on fire, the nose is on fire, the tongue is on fire, the body is on fire, the mind is on fire. What we see is on fire, what we hear is on fire, what we taste is on fire, what we smell is on fire, what we feel in our body is on fire, what we experience in our mind is on fire. It's all on fire. The whole world is on fire. So if you're a good orator, it can be much more dramatic than that. And probably have your hair standing up on end, you know. It's all on fire. Fire and brimstone, Buddhist sermon. And then he says, and what's it on fire? It's on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion. Just read the newspaper. And you'll see there's lots of this fire going on. Most things we read in the newspaper, a high percentage of them, especially on the front page, involve someone's greed, hatred, or delusion operating. The world's on fire. So he's using the metaphor of fire to talk about the suffering of the world, the challenges of the world, conflicts in the world. And so then he uses another metaphor upadana is fuel, the fuel for a fire. But he also uses that word for fuel to mean clinging. And so the play here is that the very thing that fuels the suffering in the world is clinging. Our clinging is the fuel that perpetuates further suffering. And so that what we'd like to do is to snuff out, quench the fire of suffering. The word Nibbana means quenching the fire. In the old days, in the Buddha's days, they had lights, lamps, oil lamps with, you know, little wicks and flames. And if you snuffed it out, you nirvanad the light. The word nirvana, nibbana, also refers to a horse that's been tamed or made peaceful. So you nirvanize a horse when you've tamed it and made it peaceful. So our suffering gets extinguished with the experience of nirvana, this fire. And we, who are the horse, you know, if we're like the horse, we get peaceful and calm, tamed in a certain way. So the Buddha is playing with these metaphors. And so Nibbana, remember, is a metaphor for something. But it's a metaphor primarily of this movement towards quenching, towards releasing the fire or putting out the fire that's there. And in that sense, it's an action. It's the action of quenching or ending or destroying or terminating or letting go. And many, many times, in alternative language, when the Buddha talks about the goal, the ultimate goal, he talks about it as the ending of something. Sometimes in very dramatic language, destruction, extinguishing, releasing, freeing, bringing something to an end. And it's that movement, it's an action of bringing something to an end. The simplest way of understanding this, I think, is that it's the movement of letting go. Something that's, we let go of clinging, let go of attachments, let go deeply, deeply in the mind. Nirvana is the action of release, of letting go. It's an activity of this deep, deep letting go. It's not a thing that we attain. If it's an experience, it's kind of an experience of absence. Because in the letting go, if it's thorough enough and full enough, there's nothing that fills that absence. It's a radical absence that feels like one of the best things in the world to experience, because it's so peaceful, it's so absent of clinging, of self-preoccupation, of fear, of greed, of agitation, of the mind spinning and wanting and getting and measuring and protecting and defending itself and asserting itself. To have all that put to rest in a radical way and not be there for the experience that absence you can say in English it's an experience of absence, but it's not an experience of something. But it's dramatic to have this release, this letting go. So I like to use the analogy of a fist. If I hold my hand in a fist forever, for, you know, my whole life, and I walk around, you know, holding my hand, arm up with a fist, that's going to create a certain stir in the people. You know, where you go down streets, you know, people are going to walk away from me, cross the street. You know, I can do a few things with this fist, but, you know. And then some good person comes along and says, you know, Gil, you know, you don't have to always walk around with a fist. Really, I say? But I've done this my whole life. Well, really, you can. No, you know, it's not possible. You must be deluded. There's no such thing as, you know, a non-fisted hand. No, really. Why don't we do some practicing? It's a teeny bit of practice. It helps your stress. It'll be stress reduction for you. And just a little bit. And why don't you take your little pinky and let's just open and stretch it out just a little bit. Not even all the way, but just a little bit. Doesn't that feel kind of good? Well, yeah. You know, well, try the other finger. Well, is it really safe? What about the third finger? No. I need to have it. You know, who would I be if I'm not, you know, curled up like that? You know, come on, it's okay. It's okay. You can do it. It's okay. So slowly, and then at some point, it's far enough that the whole hand just kind of springs open completely by itself. Whew. Wow. The absence of the fist. That feels really good. I had no idea. I had no idea there was such a peace and ease and goodness of an open hand. I thought we had to keep it tight all the time. Not only is it nice to not have the fist anymore, but lo and behold, the sensitive part of the hand is now available. And there's much more I can do with my hand when I have it open. It's actually a richer life, a better life with the open hand. So this feels so good, really good. So something that's that good and that important, right? What should you do? You should grasp it. Hold on to it, not share it with anybody. But you can't have it both ways. You can't have an open hand and grasp at it. You know, to make a fist again, to hold on to it. It doesn't work. So Nibbana is this radical, thorough, full letting go of clinging, of attachments of all kinds to some of the deepest seated ones. Like some of them are like attachment to being alive, to life itself. Attachment to self, me, myself, and mine. So deeply kind of, it's in our, almost like it's in our DNA or in our marrow to have these attachments. But the fact that we can actually release the fist of the mind, it can be done. And to experience that goodness of it. And people do get attached to it, but it's a little bit, as soon as you get attached to Nibbana, guess what? It's gone. Because Nibbana is not some, you know, it's this openness. So the hand is open, it's the absence of the fist. It's not the open hand. It's the space that's been created. It's not, you know, I don't know what, but so Nibbana is a action, and in fact, a few of you might actually read some of these translations of the ancient Pali texts. Many of the translators will use the word Nibbana in the English translations. They figure it's better. There's no real good English word to carry the meanings of Nibbana, so they just use Nibbana in the English translation. However, many times they're not translating Nibbana, they're translating a verb that is the actual verb for Nibbana, Nibbayati. But because that would mean to say to nirvanize, and that doesn't, you know, that's really bad English. So they write, attain nirvana. And then attain nirvana, nirvana is now a noun. It makes people think it's a thing, it's a state, it's an experience, it's something to get to. Now I find it very inspiring that nibbana is nothing. So you're not going to get a lot of, you know, you go to a party and people say, what's your religion teach? What the highest? Because my religion teaches, you know, cosmic consciousness, oneness with all things. And what does your religion teach? What's the ultimate? Nothing. Nothing. You know, you're not going to get a lot. People go, oh, and they're going to feel sorry for you. It's actually good. Because the last thing you want to do if you're going to go really all out to experience the full possibility of liberation is to create a self, an ego, a conceit that you have a really hot, good, best liberation, better than anybody else. You know, this is the best liberation from self that anybody has in the universe, and I have it. You know, that's crazy, right? So if people get feel like, oh, you have nothing? Oh, I'm sorry. Just take that as a good encouragement to not cling to anything, not want anything. Just let it just be. Just be free. Be free without any need for anybody to praise you because you have the highest. Be free without any need to be part of a great religion that has great, wonderful goals and things. If people can't understand that freedom from suffering is pretty wonderful, then that they have better goals, you can say, great, okay. When I finish with my suffering, then I'll think about your goal. But first, let's deal with this very fundamental human issue of human suffering, of attachment. And if there is something after that that seems important, then, you know, it might be a nice hobby. But, you know, it's not really necessary from a traditional Buddhist point of view, because if anything's necessary, it's freedom from suffering. That might seem like a selfish goal, to be freed from your suffering, but it's necessary, not necessary exactly, but to really be able to have compassion for other people, to wish them well, wish them free of their suffering, to really do it effectively and really know what you're talking about. It really helps if you understand how thoroughly it's possible to become free of suffering. We have much more to offer the world in terms of helping the world not suffer if we know the full depth and full breadth of possibility of this freedom from suffering. And so I don't think it is a selfish goal. In fact, selfishness is just another form of suffering. It's another form of clinging. So that has to go, even. That has to be let go of in order to attain this liberation. So teaching breath meditation in schools to relax and tell the students that if you learn to meditate for 5-10 minutes before your tests, you'll do better in your tests. That's what some kids are told. In some places where inner cities where kids grew up with violence and killings and gunshots, mindfulness of schools there is a form of trauma therapy that's proved very effective. But even people who get healed from things like trauma, they'll still suffer. It's kind of built into the human condition. And something powerful is needed to really get to the bottom of it and see it and really kind of pull out the very roots of it, or pull out that dart, pull out the thorn. And that's what the Buddhist path to liberation is for. So, is that our specialty? Should we teach it a little bit more often about it and give some emphasis to that possibility and support people to really kind of go and as far as they can on this path? Or is it better for us to spend more time teaching mindfulness in the schools, which is a very worthwhile thing to do? But is that what we should be doing? Should we be teaching? So my answer to that question is do it all. And that hopefully there's wise ways of just kind of seeing it all is important part of what we're about. In different contexts, different situations, different ways, we try to support the world in whatever way we can. But without forgetting that our specialty as Buddhists is something that is, you know, very, you know, we don't want to forget because we're busy doing other things. Not only we don't want to forget it, we really want to support people to understand it, move towards it, and really appreciate the potential we all have, the potential for freedom. So that was my day. So thank you so much.